It is 12:10 on this Wednesday afternoon. Steve Bertrand in again for Bob and Marianne on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. I am the usual host on Saturdays for the Wintrust Business Lunch, so I hope you'll make some time for me this weekend coming up, but I'll be in the rest of the week, and I think Dean Richards comes in to fill out their show from 1 to 3 this afternoon, as she is, I think. Are you here every Wednesday, Terry, just about?
Every Wednesday, yes.
Terry Savage is here. Welcome. So I guess you should welcome me because you're here more often than
I looked up and I said, wait a minute.
What's going on?
I'm so glad you're here. You do a great job on Saturdays. And I'll tell you one thing about Bob and Marianne. I know they can't pick stocks, but they sure can pick vacation times. I mean, what's a wind chill? What are we just here?
I know.
And, it's horrid.
Although they're saying maybe 50 next week, so if we could just hold out.
Okay, well, yeah, but they're gone during the worst of the cold, so they're market timing or their weather timing is better than probably my market timing.
Orion was saying in his business report, they're talking about the jobs report, and ADP came out with its monthly look. I think they said 212,000 jobs were created in January.
I think the consensus was 220,000. I just like to not get carried away. This is the precursor to the big Labor Department report, which then always gets revised again. And so I think what's happened is with this great expansion of financial news talk, media about financial things, everybody's picking up on these numbers, sometimes to the right of the decimal point. And what's going on today is the market's giving a kind of a ho-hum. The Dow's down just a little bit less than 100 points. It's pretty quiet. And, you know, here's what we know. We know the economy is chugging along. It's not going great guns, but it's moving forward. We know the consumers are spending. That's been a big part of the economy. We know that'll be offset a little in the energy patch, but the dividend from more money in your pocket seems to be going nicely into a combination of consumer spending. And
were we actually saving a little bit? Because I saw a study, was it last week, that spending was down. But our costs were down, too, because of fuel and everything.
Spending was less than consumer incomes increased. And I wrote a column. All these columns that I talk about are up at terrysavage.com. They're in the left-hand side. Scroll down or just click on the column archives, and you can see them. So I wrote a column several weeks ago about, so it's not your job as consumers to get the economy going again by spending all this dividend you're getting from lower energy prices. But, of course, people are. Some people have no choice. I mean, they're glad to have the money just to survive. Others are trying to just pay down debt a little bit. And that's always a good idea because, gosh, what you can get on the bank these days in the bank for money is nothing. But you're paying 18, 19, 29% on credit card debt. So you know me, pay that down.
I thought it was interesting, too. You just said that the market today was a ho-hum, down about a little less than 100 points. It wasn't too long ago that 100 points was like, let's break into programming.
Hey, I was around. Yes, right. I know. And but times change, volatility, volumes change.
So we look at this and say the numbers today are maybe about the jobs report. You think that's what the reflection is?
I think that's it. But there's the Fed's beige book. You know, people try and second guess the Fed coming out. And had the services sector of the economy. We had a report a little bit earlier that it is growing a little bit better than expected. So we have, this is like being in choppy waters, cross currents. There's no major trend. And there's international stuff is sort of out of the headlines for the moment. Nobody's talking about Greece today. Okay, so we said Greece. Now we are. But, I mean, nobody's talking about China. The big news was India cut its rates a little bit. So it's kind of, and I hesitate to say this because, you know, keep fingers crossed, it's kind of quiet out there in the global world of money.
The dollar is at an 11-year high today. So is that a reflection of all that? What does that mean?
No, you know, I say this every week. The dollar is strong, not because we've got our economy in such great shape or we've got our budget deficits in such great shape. They are not. The national debt continues to balloon, but by only $500 billion a year instead of a full trillion. However, when you look at us compared to everywhere else in the world, it seems like the safest place to be. Our interest rates are higher here on 10-year treasuries by far than they are even in, well, for sure in Germany, for sure in Switzerland. Interest rates are zero in Euroland. So all the money comes to the U.S., and it's pretty smart money. Some of it buys 2-year treasuries or 10-year treasuries. They'll get a little higher yield than they can get at home, but most of it goes into the stock market, pushing stock prices higher.
Okay, so I like to travel to Europe a couple times a year when I can.
Time to go.
So, what strong dollar means, that's nice. But Most of us don't travel, get a chance to do that for work or whatever. What does a strong dollar mean to just about anyone else living in Schaumburg or wherever today?
Well, you know, the truth is it doesn't mean a lot. I mean, if you're buying French wine by the case and they haven't already jacked up the prices to reflect the decline in the euro, you could buy more of imports. If you work for a multinational company and they make profits overseas, it takes more euros to equal $1. So their profits are hit by this currency translation as the value of the euro falls, for example. So it's kind of pretty esoteric, but it's not going to put more money in your pocket. What it is doing, though, is making the U.S. a very attractive place for the world to invest, and therefore it's pushing the stock market up, and you must feel pretty good about that in your 401k if you know what you own in your 401k.
I want to talk about 401ks. Maybe we'll do that after the break when we have a little bit more time. This idea of, well, let's do this now. The Fidelity you wrote about.
Okay, well, there's two
with
things.
With the IRA. Now, that's an IRA, not a 401k.
Yeah, two big columns out this week. They're both up at terrysavage.com on the left-hand side. The first one is something brand new. It's about the rise of the robo-advisor. And the second one is an incredible deal Fidelity announced just a couple of days ago.
And we'll do the robo-advisor after break. But in the minute we've got now, tell me about the Fidelity IRA move.
Okay, Fidelity is trying to gather assets. 25 years ago, they'd put up ads saying, put $2,000 in your IRA. Now they're trying to do a lot more. They've announced a deal. You know, if you're in a 401k, you get a match probably from your employer.
Right.
Fidelity has announced a deal that if you roll over a significant amount of money from another IRA, not your 401k, but at least $10,000 from an IRA, you may have in a bank, you may have at a brokerage firm, you may have at another mutual fund company, on a sliding scale, they will match up to 10% of your contributions that you make, not what you roll over, but what you the contributions you make in the next 3 years.
So right now, if you contribute to an IRA, you don't have an opportunity to have someone match those
exactly.
funds. You're investing.
Only companies match, and we all understand how important it is. It's free money.
So now Fidelity, to get your business, is going to match some of the contributions.
They want to steal competitors' assets. So let's just say you roll over a $10,000 IRA. You may have it at a bank. You may have it at Vanguard or anywhere else. Then your subsequent 3 years, and don't forget, if you're over 50, now you can put away, if you could, put away $6,500 a year in that IRA. They would give you a match. Now, it's only 1% if you roll over $10,000, but it's 10% if you roll over a $500,000 IRA. And don't laugh. A lot of people have rolled over IRAs from 401ks from past jobs.
Right, right.
So if you then roll that existing IRA into a Fidelity IRA, add over $10,000 up to a $500,000, they will match the next 3 years' contributions from, on a scale from 1 to 10%. So, wow, that's a lot of money. 3 years.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand in for Bob and Mary Ann this week. They'll be back next week just enjoying a little sun somewhere, I would imagine. Terry Savage is here, too. And so, all right, let's get into this idea of you wrote about robo-calls.
Robo-investing. No. Okay, look.
Robo-advising almost.
It is. It's advice. Okay, this is for your investments or your IRA. Look, here's how investment advice evolved. I've been around for a long time. So there were stockbrokers, and I was one way, way, way back when, and we got paid on commissions for the recommendations we made, and people stuck around if you gave them good recommendations.
Right.
Stockbrokers made a lot of money, and mutual funds came along, but brokers sold mutual funds and made a lot of money and let the professionals decide. And then came no load, no commission mutual funds. You know them as Fidelity, Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, and so forth. So, I was no longer a broker. I was Terry TV, and I said, for sure you want to use these no-load, no-commission funds because they charge low, low annual fees and no commission up front. All your money goes to work. And then people said, okay, now which mutual fund do I use? Fidelity has lots of them, or Vanguard. So then we would say, okay, well, there's some new funds that came out. There were age-based target retirement date funds. A lot of them went into your company 401k plan. You didn't have to pick from a dozen or two funds. You said, okay, I'll just say I plan to retire in 20 years and let them make the adjustments and balance them back and forth as portions of the fund do better and so forth. And there were something called Vanguard had its star funds, a little bit of every other fund for no extra management fee. So now, though, we're back in the age when people get knowledge I've always said, look, at the base of your investment should be an index fund. It's real hard to beat the market, so just buy the whole market. And I feel pretty safe recommending that as people are growing their money. But there comes a moment when you need to diversify. And how do you do that? And along now comes robo-investing.
And that's just software that you plug in your information.
A bunch of websites, and I've written about this again. The robo-investing's column is up now. It just went up at
terrysavage.com. Right.
So you can read all the details. And that is algorithms. The same ones you've heard about the high-speed traders. Well, some Nobel Prize-winning economists, the smartest minds, have applied these kinds of algorithms to giving advice for your investments, whether it's an IRA or just a regular investment account. You have to put in some information about your age, your goals, and so forth. Now, among the things they say they can do are not only maybe just by a little bit. But first of all, what does it cost? It costs very little. It costs a third of a percentage point if you have a small account. And if you have, I'll give you an example of one of these funds. It's called Betterment, Betterment. It's one of the largest, Betterment.com. You pay a very tiny amount. It's like 15 hundredths mm-hmm. of a percent mm-hmm. if you have an account over $100,000. You use their algorithms to divide up your investments. They give you recommendations. And the whole idea is not only that you beat the market a little bit, but that you also have the discipline to, A, stick to those allocations when all hell is breaking loose in the market, and B, rebalance. Suppose you were supposed to be X percent in stocks and the market just had a terrific upward run. That gives you the discipline to move. They will do that for you based on where you are in your life. Move it to different investments.
30 seconds left, though, and I think the financial advisors would be saying, right, but we're handholders. We're emotion. We help reassure, and there's value there, right?
I couldn't agree more in the value of having a good financial advisor. I've always said it's worth paying for good advice. There's a whole do-it-yourself generation that has been doing it themselves by watching CNBC and listening to whoever was hot. I love Cramer. He endorsed my book. But that's not how you create a portfolio. So by all means, if you have someone you trust who's been giving you good advice, it's worth paying for it. But if you just want to roll over your IRA and say, you know, I know myself, I always sell at the bottom, I always buy at the top, someone discipline me, this might be a route you want to take.
That's Terry Savage. You can read more about it at terrysavage.com. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
The news with Kim Gordon right around the corner on 720 WGN.
More on the Wintrust Business Lunch coming up on 720 WGN.
All right, thank you, Kim Gordon, Steve Bertrand in the Showcase Studio, the Allstate Showcase Studio. This week from 12 to 1, filling in for Bob and Marianne on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You can follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on Facebook at Steve Bertrand on Books. I hope you'll do that. Or send me an email at sbertrand@wgnradio.com. SteveBertrand@wgnradio.com works as well. And if you've got maybe 10 or 15 more minutes, Scott Kleinberg, I'll run down all the other ways that now we are in contact with one another.
Excellent.
There are about six more ways, I think. But Scott, welcome to the show from the WGN Tribune, or from the Tribune, I should say, the social media expert there. So I was reading your column this week, and you know, we were talking off the air about how I think I'm involved in social media. I've got my toe in. I've got two toes in it, right? Excellent. But I'm not especially intelligent when it comes to it. So I'm reading your column about Facebook and about this other mailbox, which mm-hmm. I had no idea existed until, and I suspect you've heard from a lot of people who see that too.
I've heard from a lot of people who have said that too. And if you haven't looked, I mean, this is like one of the simplest things you can do. If you click where you check your messages, there are two tabs. There's the regular inbox, which is what it comes up as, and then the other inbox. And the thing about the other inbox is it's a great idea. It's supposed to house all the spam that you don't want to see in your regular messages, and it's supposed to take all the stuff from people who aren't your friends and just put it in an organized way.
So if you come upon someone that you see on Facebook that you're not friends with, but you want to send them something,
Right.
That goes to other.
It goes to other. But in a lot of cases, it's also stuff that you just don't want to read. And because there's so much spam, people just skip the inbox or don't even realize that it's there totally.
I did not know it was there.
And so many people have written me and said that they have found notes from a year ago, 3 years ago, people they grew up with. The reason why I wrote this column is because I was reconnected with a high school friend from 25 years ago who wrote me back in May, and I just found this note 3 weeks ago. I felt terrible, but I was so happy to reconnect with him.
It's almost like going through your attic, even though
it is, yeah.
Even though the original memories never really existed, right?
I mean, you know,
you're not rekindling them. But so I went through my Facebook page today, my other mailbox.
Yep, yep.
And I had probably 25 emails from people.
Yeah.
And there were listeners, you know, so not people who I knew.
Right.
Who wanted to contact, and they go back a couple years.
Right.
And
right.
I apologize now to you publicly for not answering, because I had no idea it was there.
But now, you know, I think now that people know it's there, or if Facebook could do a better job letting people know it was there, I think they'd find it's like you said about the attic. It's like a social media attic, and there's a treasure trove of stuff inside.
Can you disable it?
No, you can't disable it. You can. No, I don't think there's a way to get rid of it. I think everything flows there if it's not somebody who you're friends with.
Right,
and
that's
Facebook
where it
has tried to like expand it by doing these crazy things. Like for celebrities, something will pop up and say, if you pay $5, we'll send a message to this person's inbox and skip this inbox. No one's ever going to pay. So it's like they have to just revamp the whole system.
The other thing you wrote about is the like button. And someone said, who said this last week that it's the laziest thing in the world or on the web or something like that. Everyone likes something. It totally is. And so I try to push different things sometimes, and I'm like, got 262 likes.
Sure. I think way back when, I think the like button was a smart idea until we realized that the like button would be used for everything. And the problem is people don't want to click like on certain things. When someone posts and says that there's a death in the family, the last thing they want to do is click like. But they do, because that's how they get more information about what the rest of the post is going to say. And some people even write that in the comments. They say, I obviously don't like this, but there's no way for me to follow it other than clicking like. My idea, and I don't know if it's original, but my idea has always been a sympathy button. That way, Facebook doesn't want to have an unlike button because they don't want it to be negative. But a sympathy button basically says, not just for death, a sympathy button says, I'm with you.
Maybe a Bill Clinton empathy button.
Yeah, there you
right?
go.
I feel your pain.
There you go. That or have work. Little popping heads of different people like Bill Clinton. I'd
right.
click that, totally.
Right. That's funny because, so I might be completely wrong here, but when I click like,
yep.
I'm thinking that in a way, I'm not sharing it as in posting it,
correct.
But I'm drawing attention to this post to everyone else who follows me or something.
That is correct. You're doing that, but you're also getting a notification whenever someone else comments or
right.
updates the
right.
post. If you don't do that, you may never know without going back to that person's page that it's been updated.
So, you know, my face, I am never on, I'm a Facebook user, but never mm-hmm. on Facebook.
Does okay.
That, okay.
Yep.
So I'm more on Twitter. I'm more active watching Twitter.
Sure.
And I have it set up so that when I post on Twitter, when I tweet, mm-hmm. it goes to my Facebook page and posts there as well.
So okay.
And
okay.
then when someone comments on that, I get an email.
Okay.
And that's how I know.
That's one way to do it. We usually say, and I mean this is not saying everybody has to do it this way, we usually say it's better to populate them separately, simply because when you do one and you do the same thing on the other, you're basically saying to the person, follow me here or here, versus here
and here. Here, I see.
Here and here means I have something unique here and here.
Well, the other thing of that too is that if and I've tried to police this, but if I tweet something mm-hmm. and abbreviate it with hashtags and at signs and
yes.
all that, and then that shows up on my Facebook page,
yes.
that tells my Facebook followers that they're second.
Yes, it tells them that they're second, and there's some things that don't transfer over. Hashtags now work on Facebook, but at symbols don't always. At symbols work if you know the name of the Facebook page, but if there's no corresponding page, it just comes across with an at symbol, and you know right away that it was a tweet before when you see that.
We got a couple minutes. Tell me about what's going on with Google+, because that's another one of those that was sort of on my bookshelf, a book I was going to read,
yeah,
and I never got past the table of contents.
I'm totally with you on that. It's crazy because they've had different people at Google who have been in charge of Google+, and people have left kind of quickly, and now they're saying that they're splitting it up into Google Streams and Google Photos, and no one at Google seems to know what this platform is. And the problem is, if the people at Google don't know what the platform is, the users certainly aren't going to. And users, just like you're talking about, they just don't know what to do with it. So they stay away from it because it confuses them.
And these are like the Google, the circles and all of that. That's what we're talking about?
The right. circles and that kind of thing. When Google first started Google Plus, they wanted it to be like an extension of your Gmail. Your contents are here. And instead of using Facebook, you'll just come here and talk to everybody in your Google world about that. But it just wasn't practical because Facebook was already too big.
So a couple of big losses for Google then recently, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's something I don't think they're going to be able to get back from. I mean, they know now that it can't compete with Facebook. That, I think, is a realization. Now they have to realize what they want it to be. There's a lot of power in photos and that kind of stuff, so they can do something with that. But calling it a social network is something that I think they're going to realize is not going to work.
Scott Kleinberg, the social media expert from the Chicago Tribune, nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll come back, and when we do, we'll check a traffic hotspot, and then around the corner, we're going to look at how much you're paying for your health care insurance. Is it going up? And if it is, whose fault is it? And is your boss keeping up with you? That's all just ahead on the Wintrust Business Lunch. All right. Thank you, Orion. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Esmeralda. If you're following the news today at all, you know that the Supreme Court is considering the Obamacare law again, the health care overhaul. And this has to do with the different insurance markets that were set up and whether or not the Congress can or the federal government can give subsidies to people who live in states where there is not a state health care market. It's sort of confusing. It's absolutely confusing, actually. But the idea is that there were a lot of governors. And I think originally, I'm not sure, I can't speak for every governor or every situation, but in a way it became people who didn't like the law. They weren't going to set up the market, so they were going to make it harder. So the federal government said, okay, we will set up the market for those states where there's not a state market and then give people the subsidy there. Well, the state sued, said that the health care law doesn't say that they can do that. And it, I mean, I'm no expert and I haven't read the law, but it seems to me that it also says that. The question is whether the Supreme Court will say, well, it was the Congress's intent or this is big enough to where we will continue to enforce it or allow it to apply. If they don't, it could wreak havoc, really, on not just the law, but on millions of people who are getting subsidies now. They could lose it. They could lose it very quickly. When it comes to healthcare costs, there was another study out this week that caught my eye. Almost everyone in the healthcare system is seeing some savings under Obamacare, but employee costs are still going up. That comes from the Center for American Progress. It's a left-leaning think tank out of Washington. They looked at some numbers. Mara Kalson is the director of health policy at the Center for American Progress, and she is with us this afternoon on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Mara, welcome to WGN. Maura, welcome to WGN. I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
I apologize. Hello? For that. Yes.
Oh.
So tell me about this, because first of all, the assertion that everyone's costs are going down under this law, did I read that correctly? Is that a fair thing to say? Because costs are going up, I thought.
Well, I think that what part of what makes the Affordable Care Act so confusing is the part of the law that you just discussed in your intro, the part that is at question today in the before the Supreme Court is the part that deals with people who buy their insurance individually through the new marketplaces. And what my organization and our group tried to do was we tried to take a look at a very different part of the healthcare market, and that's the part of the healthcare market that most Americans are a part of. It's the employer-sponsored insurance market. So
that's for the rest of us. We get our insurance through our job.
And about half of all Americans.
I think I read in your report, or the summary of it anyway, that those positions, those situations, really aren't affected too much one way or another by the Obamacare law when it comes to costs. Is that true?
Well, the law really, what the law tried to do was build around our employer-sponsored insurance market. So what has happened is, thanks in part to the law, growth in overall healthcare costs has started to slow quite dramatically over the last few years. But people who are covered through their employer's insurance are not really seeing the slowdown. And what we tried to do was quantify how much savings employers are seeing versus how much their employees are seeing.
All right, let's get to that then. You look at numbers from 2007 to 2013. You say employee expenses are up 21%, employer expenses are up 14.5%.
That's correct. And I think the other point that's important for people to know is employee costs actually are increasing faster than overall health care costs, and employers' costs are growing slower than the total cost.
And that's because the employers are passing more of their costs on to us, the employees.
Yes, that's correct.
And we might blame Obamacare, or we might blame the insurance company, and some of that might be fair blame sometimes, but it's also true that the employers are making a shift. They're keeping more, and they're also paying, by and large, well, I think almost two-thirds of our insurance costs. So, I mean, they certainly are paying the majority, but they're shifting more of the cost to the worker rather than the employer.
Right. What the employers are doing is, in some cases, they're paying a small their share of what the premium they're paying. It might not be as large as they're asking the increased share for the premium for the employees. They're also increasing cost sharing. So things like when you go and pick up a prescription, you might have to pay more. When you go see a doctor, you might have to pay more out of pocket.
So that's
they're
bad.
Also increasing deductibles.
That's bad for the workers who are paying more. But there's a benefit too, isn't there? Because if I as a worker or an employee have to spend more of my money, I'm going to be a little more careful with how I spend it, and that's led to the drop in healthcare costs around the country, right? So there is that benefit.
It has. I think that you have to be careful, though, because it's a real trade-off and it's a fine line. I think that, you know, making sure that individuals know how much they're paying for health care is very important. Making sure that people are paying, making sure that people are encouraged to go see high-value providers is really important. But especially for low and moderate-income individuals, these types of cost-sharing arrangements can be really harmful.
Right, and I'm all about that, Maura, because I do think that, you know, I think that business has used this sort of the stability argument or other things, you know, but to sort of, in many ways, squeeze the workers. I mean, we're not making any more money. Businesses are back. They're doing very well, and things are getting moved more and more to employees. So I'm very sympathetic to that. I don't mean to sound as if I'm not. But it's not illegal, right? It's not wrong. Is it something that needs to be fixed? And if it does, how do you fix it? I guess that's B, C, and E, too.
I'll try to tackle all of those then. I think it's understandable for employers to want to try to experiment with ways to lower costs. But I think that what we found, they really are shifting costs in a way that might not be the most appropriate. So I think that the first recommendation we have is to increase transparency, because right now there's a real lack of transparency about this cost shift, and it's keeping many employees in the dark about these trends.
Right.
So if employees have all the information they need, they can, you know, better assess changes to their total compensation, which includes their health care costs.
When my rate goes up, I just assume it's a reflection of the market. Everyone's rates are going up. But that's not always the case.
Exactly.
All right. We've got just 30 seconds more. So tell me about this idea of a shared rebate.
Right. In more extreme situations, we think that if the employer's health care costs grow at a significantly lower rate than their competitors, because it shifted cost to employees, we would ask employers to then share half of those savings with their employees.
Any chance of that ever happening?
Well, never say never, but it would be a very heavy lift.
You're the champion of this, and even you're giggling a little bit. Yeah, that's a lot to ask for.
Yes, but I think it's an important conversation to start.
Well, I love the numbers. I think that it's a real eye-opener, and people can find out more from you. It's the Center for American Progress. Maura Kalson, the Director of Health Policy at the Center. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it. You shed some light on it for us.
Thanks so much.
We'll take a break. The news and Dean Richards just around the corner on 720 WGN.